Good morning to you all, and it is a privilege to be with you. I'm not going to take any time today to bring greetings from the UK. I can do that tomorrow, but I want to go straight into what we're doing. This may be a little bit new to some of you, I don't know, but what I'm wanting to do is to tell you the story of two great empires of the ancient Middle Eastern world and their impact on the history of Israel and Judah. The more you know your Old Testament history, the clearer everything will be, but I'm not going to assume too much, so I hope I'll have time to explain as we go along. The theme of what we're doing here, and if you can't see the screen properly, do move around until you can, because it will help you enormously if you can keep your eye on the screen. Incidentally, that's just the frontage of the British Museum, it's not the Parthenon or anything like that. I want to show you how discoverers of archaeology throw light onto many biblical texts. Now let me say, and you won't forget this, we do not believe the Bible is true because archaeology says so. That's the wrong way round. But on the other hand, in the realm of apologetics, it is good to know that when people make these stupid statements like, well, of course, archaeology has disproved the Bible, like they say, science has disproved the Bible. We can have some answers that come back at them, because when people make those statements, it's always a good idea to say, would you like to give me an example? Because 99 times out of 100, they have no idea what they're saying. But if some parts of the story I tell you now surprise you because of their obvious support for the accuracy of the Bible, I want to assure you that I'll be making no claim that is not almost universally accepted by archaeologists, whether or not they believe the Bible. I don't make claims that are only possible maybes and ifs. So that any positive claim I make will be almost universally accepted. I have to say almost, because there are always what we call minimalists in the archaeological world who will hardly allow the Bible to be true anywhere. If there's a perhaps, I will say so. Otherwise, you can take it as a fact. Now, the most powerful and terrifying country of the ancient world was probably Assyria. And at its most powerful, it reached all the way from the Egyptian Nile Delta right the way down to the Persian Gulf. And it contained the whole of that dark shaded area that you're looking at the moment. And woe betide anyone who stood in its way. One of their kings, called Shalmaneser III, boasted, and I quote, that he smashed all his enemies as if they were earthenware. He described himself as the strong man, unsparing, who shows no mercy in battle. In fact, he claimed that he often made a pillar of skulls outside the town that he had defeated, and he dyed the mountains with their blood. Shalmaneser, around 853 BC, actually refers to Ahab the Israelite. What Ahab had done was to adjoin, and you remember Ahab was the king of Israel, you know, husband of Jezebel, we'll take a look at her in a moment. He had joined a coalition of 12 kings to oppose Shalmaneser, and this is Shalmaneser, thought you might like to see what he looked like. And on this stela erected in his honor, of course, Shalmaneser informs us that, I quote, Ahab the Israelite, he put 2,000 chariots into the battle and 10,000 infantry, and of course Shalmaneser defeated the coalition. Now, the particular battle that we're talking about that took place in 853 BC is not mentioned in the Bible, but this is one of the many, many occasions when pagan kings of the surrounding nations actually refer to Israelite or Judean kings in their records. Shalmaneser claims, as I say, that he slew altogether, he claims that he slew 14,000 of their soldiers, descending upon them like Adad when he makes a rainstorm pour down, and he adds that there wasn't sufficient room to bury the corpses. They loved to boast about these kind of things. However, there's much more to the story of Shalmaneser, and I'll tell you a little bit more in a moment. But before we come to that, just take a look at this. Ahab had been a bad king, but his wife was even worse, and her name has come down to us as an example of evil. Not many parents call their daughters Jezebel. However, she may, interestingly, have left us another legacy. Because in 1960, an interesting seal came into the possession of the Israel Department of Antiquities. The seal has the Hebrew consonants ZBL around the outside of it. Originally, you must understand, Hebrew is a consonantal language. There are no vowels to it, only consonants. Scholars debate whether it belonged to the infamous wife of Ahab. Now, to help us decide, just consider the following. This seal is larger and more decorative than any other seal with a Hebrew inscription belonging to a woman, and therefore it must have belonged to somebody very important. The broken part at the top, this section up there. Can you actually see my little red dot? Because I won't bother to use it if you can't. That bit's broken. As you can see, I didn't really need to point it out, did I? But the broken part at the top would allow for two missing Hebrew characters. One would be the letter L, which meant belonging to. That's quite commonly used. And the other would be the first letter of the name of Jezebel, because that name is missing. What is there is ZBL. And so if you put the letter L and the letter J in there, you actually have Jezebel round the outside. What everyone pretty much agrees to is that the seal is dated to the 9th century BC, which makes it contemporary with Ahab and his Phoenician queen. And all the Egyptian symbols around it are references to royalty. For example, you have here a sphinx. It is the sphinx with the body of a lioness and the head of a woman, and that would make it royalty. You have here the Ankh symbol, A-N-K-H, which is a symbol of life, and you will always see Egyptian kings and dignitaries carrying it. It was a bit like a lucky charm, like I'm afraid so many people wear a cross around their neck, that they would always carry this in their hand. You have here two cobra. And that's a symbol of royalty. You have the hat or crown on the ibis. That is also a symbol of royalty. This little thing here is the winged sun god. So in all, it is simply a ring that belonged to someone. If it wasn't Jezebel, it belonged to someone very important, a royal lady called Jezebel at the time Ahab lived. You can decide whether or not it belonged to Jezebel or not. There are archaeologists who dispute that. But let's get back to Shalmaneser for a moment. If I were to ask you the question, who brought Formula One to Israel? Any idea? Well, it shouldn't be too difficult. Because actually, according to the lookout at Jezreel, Jehu drove his chariot like a madman, 2 Kings 9:20. And he was also a ruthless royal assassin, because 2 Kings 9-10 tells us that he killed Jehoram, Ahab's son and successor, as well as Ahaziah, the king of Judah. So he killed the king of Israel and Judah. And then he massacred Ahab's entire family, including his 70 sons, and including the infamous Jezebel. Do you remember how he drove into town and shouted out when she looked out the window, all dressed in her finery and a painted face, and he said, "Who's on my side?" Two servants popped their heads out, and they threw her down, and she was eaten by the dogs. You remember that pleasant story? So Jehu had made a huge number of enemies, and he needed a friend, because now Israel's neighbor, Syria, was knocking on Jehu's front door, according to 2 Kings 10:32. So Jehu felt he needed some friends. Who better to get on side than the big guy, Shalmaneser III of Assyria? So Jehu took along a few presents to Shalmaneser. Now, this black limestone block pictures the kings of the nations bringing presents to Shalmaneser III. And the inscription above the second row down on one side tells us, I quote, "Jehu of the house of Omri brought tribute," and the rest of the line all the way round it, because it's four sides and the story, as it were, goes right round it, gives us the inventory of the things he brought. Now, the kneeling figure is likely to be that of Jehu himself. And this, to date, is the only contemporary carving of an Israelite king that we have. And I would add, that's not surprising. Can you tell me why it might not be surprising? Why do you think the Israelites or the Judeans would not have had a carving of their own king? Because all the other nations did. second commandment, to make a graven image. Therefore, if people say to you, well, we haven't found an image of David or Solomon or any of the other kings, that is not surprising. It's what we expect. This is the only image to date, and of course it wasn't done by an Israelite. It was done by Shalmaneser of the III of Assyria. And since I mentioned David, no evidence of David the king of Israel had ever been found outside the Bible. And therefore, it was common practice among archaeologists to conclude that the stories of David and Solomon were made up around the 6th century BC when the Jews were in exile, in Persian exile. And they were stories made up under this legendary hero, a kind of Robin Hood, if you will, legendary hero to keep up the morale of the Jews when they were in exile. So he wasn't real, he never existed, but his stories were only made up in the 6th century. Some actually take it down to the 3rd century BC. Keep that in your mind. Because in July 1993, a broken basalt inscription was found at Tel Dan in northern Israel. Massive interest in the world of archaeology was raised because of this, because the Tel Dan inscription is unquestionably dated, no one disputes this, to 796 BC. Let's call that 800 BC. And it refers to the House of David, the dynasty of David. That means that the dynasty of King David was known around 250 years before the stories of David were supposedly made up by Jewish scribes around the 6th century BC. You still have a few archaeologists that are struggling. Some of them tell us that that House of David, really, David is another name for the Jewish king, the Jewish God. There are some who are actually telling us that. But when they fall back on that kind of argument, instead of just raising their hands in surrender and saying, okay, so maybe David was a real figure after all, the pendulum is now swinging back, and even the minimalists are beginning to say, perhaps, just perhaps, there was a real figure of David. Remember, we do not need the archaeological discoveries to tell us that there was a David. But it helps when they actually have to admit as much. Now, 80 years after Shalmaneser III, Tiglath-Pileser established himself on the throne of Assyria. There he is in his chariot. Fortunately, because Tiglath-Pileser is a bit of a mouthful, he's known to the Greeks, the Babylonians, and the Bible as Pul, and you will find him in your Bible as P-U-L. But if you use some modern translations, like the New International Version, can't remember what the ESV does, but I think it does the same, they actually put in Tiglath-Pileser. But actually, the Hebrew is Pul, because that's not a mistake, that's just how he's known by other nations surrounding. And Tiglath-Pileser set out to invade Israel, whose king, Menahem, in the Bible, decided that, like Jehu, it's wise to be proactive. So he offered Tiglath-Pileser, according to 2 Kings 15, 1,000 talents of silver, quote, to gain his support and strengthen his hold on the kingdom. Now, Pull in his records has a slightly different spin on this. He claims, I quote, that he overwhelmed him, this was Menahem, and he fled like a bird alone. However, Tiglath boasts that he returned him to his place, put him back on his throne, imposed a large fine on Menahem, and carried off all the inhabitants and their possessions to Assyria. Now here is Tiglath-Pileser celebrating the capture of Ashtoreth in north of Gilead, and the prisoners being taken away there are Israelite prisoners. I often think there's a little bit of government spin here, because you'll notice that the Assyrian soldier in charge of them is quite a head shorter than they are. And it's almost as if they're saying, you see, even one of our little guys is better than your big guys. But these are Israelite prisoners from Tiglath-Pileser, Tiggy the Terrible, as I call him, taking them away into captivity. And remember, all these stories are in the Bible. It's just that I'm showing you them dug out of the ground. Now, how did you make your mark in the ancient world? How did you have your ID card? How did you have your visa card? Well, the answer was you had a seal. It may be kept on your finger as a ring. It may be larger than that, like we saw Jezebel's. You actually impressed that seal into soft clay, And the impression it made was called a bulla, B-U-L-L-A, and you put an E on it if you want to pluralize it. And so you have the seal and the bulla. Keep those two words in mind because you'll see some of each. Thousands of seals and their clay impressions have been found in the ancient world, including a few belonging to kings of Israel and Judah or their servants. We're going to look at one or two, but we'll just start with this one because this is the seal of bulla, of King Ahaz. Now, interestingly, this was used to seal a papyrus document because the imprint of the papyrus and the string that bound the scroll appears on the other side of it. In fact, interestingly, this actually even has a fingerprint on it. So we might even have the fingerprint of Ahaz itself, but that's going to be a little bit difficult to prove. And it reads, belonging to Ahaz, son of Jehotam, which is Jotham, king of Judah, precisely as you find his name in 2 Kings 16 and verse 1. There is no question but that you are looking at a seal of King Ahaz. But let's get back to the Assyrians. Sargon was the new king of Assyria. He claims to have defeated Samaria in 722 BC after a 3-year siege because Hoshea, king of Israel, was treacherously planning a treaty with Egypt. Sargon records, in his own records, quote, I besieged and conquered the town of Samaria, led away as prisoners 27,290, counted them carefully, inhabitants of it, and settled therein people from countries which I myself had conquered. Now remember, the pattern in the ancient world was you conquer a nation, you ship off the cream of the population, and you bring in people from other nations. So you're watering down the possibility of any opposition. That's how Daniel wound up in Babylon eventually. Now, these foreigners that came in chiefly came from Babylon, and they brought their own religious practices with them. And this perfectly aligns with the account given in 2 Kings chapter 17. Sargon says he brings them in, and the Bible said he brings them in. And from now on, the inhabitants of Samaria, the capital of Israel, became a mixed race with a mixed religion. I'm sorry, I should have followed through. I didn't realize you were desperate to see what he looked like. Well, that's what Sargon looks like, okay? And these people became now a mixed group, and they brought their religions in and they stirred it in the pot of the worship of Yahweh in the north. And of course, they became a people of a mixed religion. And this is why in the time of Jesus, 700 years later, the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans. And we have to say it's all his fault. So remember Sargon when you read that passage in John 4 and verse 7, the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. This is why, because 700 years earlier, this guy brought all the rubbish people back into the north and they mixed up the religion. Now, the question, however, is, was there really such a king as Sargon? Because until 1843, the only known reference to Sargon came in one single verse in the book of Isaiah, chapter 20, verse 1. In the year that the supreme commander sent by Sargon, king of Assyria, came to Ashdod and attacked and captured it. And because of that, some scholars said, there never was such a king, it's just a name made up by Isaiah. That was genuinely believed by many of them. And then, in 1843, the archaeologist Paul Emil Botha, French archaeologist, vice consul to Mosul in Iraq, uncovered the great city of Khorsabad, and he found the palace and library of a king. Guess who? King Sargon. Sargon is now one of the best known kings of the ancient world and one of the most powerful rulers in the ancient world. And here he is. With his son, that's Sennacherib. Sargon began a brand new capital for himself on the banks of the river Tigris. It took 10 years to build, and it covered an area a mile square. That's the size of the city of London. And the palace was guarded by huge 10-ton 15 feet high, human-headed winged bulls. Their purpose was to scare away the evil spirits and to intimidate other people that come. They're supposed to be scaring you. That's their object, and they fail completely if you look at them without being scared. And all of this, these huge 10-ton, 15 feet high human-headed winged bulls, and they are quite impressive. If you consider, for example, that somebody standing here and is about up there. So they are quite impressive. Well, all of which is not bad, actually, for a king who never existed. Now, I want to take you to Sennacherib, because Sargon didn't have very much time to care for, to enjoy his brand new city. He was killed in battle in 705 BC. And his son Sennacherib succeeded him. Now, Sennacherib is particularly important, and I'm going to tell you a story about Sennacherib and a king called Hezekiah. Hezekiah was one of the best kings of Judah. Great spiritual revival broke out in his time. And at the end of that time, he made an alliance with Babylon, Merodach-Baladan of Babylon. And that caused a bit of trouble. God warned him he shouldn't have done it, and he did it. He was boasting and showing off, and he suffered for it. Now, Sennacherib, as soon as he came to power, you'll read about him in the Bible, he moved his capital back to Nineveh, and he decorated his palace with 2 miles of wall panel sculptures. But first, he set out to bring some of his rebellious subjects to heel, and Hezekiah, king of Judah, was one of them. Hezekiah, I say, had marked his card by chatting up Merodach-Baladan II, king of Babylon, and withholding the tribute he should have been paying to Sennacherib. And the Assyrian king wanted his money back, so he set out to settle with Hezekiah. His own records tell us that his army left nothing but misery in its wake. Cities, villages, the countryside were burned, plundered, utterly destroyed. Women and children were carried into slavery. Thousands of men and boys were flayed alive, burned, or impaled on stakes and left to die in agony. Others were blinded and dismembered. He left all of this on record because he was so proud of it all. Sennacherib records, quote, "As to the Jew Hezekiah, I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinities." Lord Byron, in his famous poem on the Assyrians, speaks of the Assyrians coming down on Israel like a wolf on the fold. Finally, the merciless army reached the city of Lachish, about 25 miles north of Israel. Opposite direction, southwest of Jerusalem. And in his victory room at Nineveh, Sennacherib left an amazing visual aid of the battle for Lachish that remained undiscovered until 1847. Now, in his victory room, he described the entire battle of Lachish. So you had a story of the Bible just coming out of the ground. The room, as it's depicted now, is actually, it's nearly the length of your church here, and then it comes all the way round to about there, and covers part of that as well. So you have an entire battle scene as high as the wall of your church up to there. And that's how we know much. It's still considered to be the most famous depiction of an ancient warfare, as you'll see in just a moment. This is how we know what a battering ram looks like and how we could make battering rams based upon the one you're just about to see. So here we are, the Battle of Lachish. It's a very active picture. You just have to realize this is just one panel. This little bit takes sort of just that little bit there, and it goes all the way. You've got the army lined up there, and you've got the stormtroopers coming into the city here, and you've got the firebrands coming down. Just if you look at the picture here, you have a huge amount going on, because there are missiles and firebrands coming down. Sorry, not sure where we've got to here. All right, here we go. Can you see the battering ram there? It'll come out for you in a moment anyway. Going up, pummeling the wall. There are 3 men in the battering ram. There's the fireman, and his job is to ladle water over the outside of the ram so that the firebrands that are coming down, all those ice cream cones that look as if they're being dropped down, are actually firebrands. You see them, all these sort of inverted ice cream cones? They are trying to set light to this, and the fireman is trying to stop them. This guy is called the archer, pretty obvious what he's doing. There was a third man in it called the driver, and I'm not sure that they'd invented the internal combustion engine by then, so I'm not sure what he was doing. And you'll realize it's a little bit out of scale. But this is the siege ramp. You can go to the city today, the remains of it, and you can actually see the siege ramp. They reckon something like 17,000 tons of rubble were used. And of course this gave a problem to the defenders up here, because the slave labor would have been Israelite slaves being used to make the battering, to make the siege ramp. And they had the choice. They either killed their own countrymen or they allowed them to build the siege ramp. Out of the city you have people being led away into captivity. And down here in the bottom corner, can you see them? These are men who have been staked. They literally put a stake through the stomach or through the groin and left them to die. This was actually the forerunner of crucifixion. They didn't crucify in these days. Nobody had thought of that. These are the Assyrians. The Persians took it one stage further. Incidentally, when you read in the story of Esther that Haman was hung, some of the old translations say that Haman, you remember, he's the one that plotted against the Jews, and the king Xerxes, who was Esther's husband, he ordered him to be put to death. And some say he was hung. He wasn't hung. They took a beam out of his house and he was staked like this. The Persians took it one stage further. The Romans perfected the science of crucifixion, which was how you could kill a man with the greatest possible pain over the longest possible amount of time. Some men could hang for as much as 3 days on a cross before they finally expired. That down there, you have people coming out of the city, fleeing from the city, and you've got the stormtroopers clambering up to get into the city. Then you have prisoners being taken away on carts with whatever they can bring with them. And at the end of it all, you have some of the leaders literally being flayed alive. Those guys, they are just right at the end here and they're being skinned alive. And do you notice the children are being made to watch? And the message is quite simple. See, watch what's happening to your dad. And if you step out of line with the Assyrians, this will happen to you. And then you have the soldiers taking some of the booty out of the city. They look like probably sacred things that have come out of a place of worship. And finally, you come to the great king himself sitting on the throne, Sennacherib, king of the world. There's a text above him in cuneiform writing, and the text reads, Sennacherib, king of the world, king of Assyria, on a seat he sat and the booty of Lachish passed before him. Do you notice that the king's face has been hacked out? And that is because the Babylonians, when they've eventually defeated Nineveh about 100 years later, they would have hacked the face out. If you hacked the face out, it means the person never existed. He ceases to be. And if you go to Lachish today, as I say, you can actually see the siege ramp wandering up the side of the broken city. That is a story that comes straight out of the Bible. But take a look at this, because this is something you won't remember, and the kids here, you'll be interested to keep this, you'll never forget this. At the beginning of the battle, you've got a group of men who are the stone slingers. Can you see them there, right on the left-hand side? They've got a stone in one hand, and they're swinging their sling on the other hand, and look at their feet, you've got a little pile of stones at their feet. Take a close look at that, so you get an idea of it. That'll help you to fix it in your mind. There they are, the stones that they're... Now, according to Judges 20 and verse 16, so far the oldest known textual reference of to the sling, the tribe of Benjamin had 700 men who with a sling in their left hand could sling a stone at a hare, this kind of hare, and not miss. In fact, Chronicles goes on to say there were some men who could do it either in their right or their left hand. We need to remember that the stone slinger was one of the most valuable men in the military. In fact, the Romans made sure that every soldier, every legionary, could sling stones because they were artillery, a barrage of artillery going up. And you may want to know how big the stones were. These stones that you're seeing now, the very stones, were actually retrieved from the gate of Lachish. These go back to 701 BC, the battle we've just been describing in the time of Hezekiah, and those are the stones. They are the size of a billiard ball, a pool ball, And they could travel at 60 miles an hour and reach a quarter of a mile. Now, remember, who fought a big giant? David. And you have a little ditty sometimes that you sing. Do you remember? Yeah. Only a boy called David, only a rippling brook, only a boy called David. Five little stones he took. He did nothing of the kind. He wasn't looking for five little pebbles. Listen, he had killed a lion and a bear. And he didn't do it with his bare hands. He didn't go up to Mr. Lion and say, come here, and rip his throat out. He used his sling. And he shot one of those at him and stunned the animal and then went and killed him. And that's exactly what he did with Goliath. He put one of those in his sling. And when poor old Goliath got that in his forehead, he was a dead man before he got out of his tent that morning. He hadn't a chance because he was using infantry against artillery. David knew how to fight a battle. And interestingly, he didn't actually kill. He stunned him, and then he went across. And what did he do? He drew his sword and cut off his head. Now, actually, I wasn't going to tell you all this. It's a bit macabre, isn't it? But it's Saturday morning, so it's all right. Actually, in the ancient world, and I haven't got a picture here, but I could show you many instances of this. The only way you showed yourself to be a battle hero was the number of heads of your enemy you could collect. And there are many pictures of men being awarded for their, when I say pictures, you understand stone carvings, of men being awarded military honors, and at their feet is a pile of human heads. And the interesting thing is, you see, that when David went over, when he knocked the giant down with his sling, the Philistine army didn't move. When did they break and run? It was when he had gone over, drawn the Goliath's sword, cut off his head, and he would have held it up like that. And at that moment, the battle was over, and the Philistines ran. Actually, the Bible says he then later came into the presence of Saul, still carrying Goliath's head. That may sound rather unnecessary and macabre for us, but it was, of course, the mark of success. After all, you can cut off just about anything else from a man, and he can still survive. If you cut off his head, he isn't very much good for anything. I say there's a spiritual lesson there, because Jesus Christ is our head. And when we're out of line with him and cut off from him, we are useless. The church is nothing. Remember that? I don't think you'll forget it, will you? Now, we haven't finished with Hezekiah, because he, remember, meanwhile, is holed up in Jerusalem. Lachish has been defeated. The army is now prepared to come to Jerusalem. And he sends out Sennacherib sends out his ambassadors to Jerusalem. With the destruction of the last main fortified city of Lachish and the relentless approach of the Assyrian war machine, Hezekiah panicked, according to Isaiah 36:1-2, which informs us Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. Then the king of Assyria sent his field commander with a large army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. So Hezekiah had plan A. The plan A was to strip the gold and silver from the temple in Jerusalem and pay off Sennacherib. 30 talents of gold, the Bible says, 300 talents of silver, 2 Kings chapter 18. Sennacherib has a list of that very same tribute, 30 talents of gold, same figure, but he has 800 talents of silver. And for a long time, archaeology says, of course, the Bible's got it wrong. I mean, you've got to believe Sennacherib over the Bible, haven't you? Actually, both are right, because we now know that whereas both of them weighed gold the same, and the Israelites weighed silver just as silver, for the Assyrians, silver could include much more. It could include other goods as well, even household items. So 800 talents of silver doesn't just mean silver, it can mean other things as well. So there's no discrepancy. Now, the panel you're looking at, which is actually under the stomach of one of those winged bulls, not the one you saw, but another one similar, includes the most detailed surviving account of the tribute sent by Hezekiah to Sennacherib in a vain attempt to stem the onward march of the army through Judea in 701 BC. The Assyrian king pocketed the tribute and continued his advance. Plan A failed. So Hezekiah fell back on plan B. He made an alliance with the Pharaoh of Egypt. And before long, quote, 2 Kings 19, Sennacherib received a report that Taharqa, the Cushite king of Egypt, was marching out to fight against him. Now, Sennacherib's own records refer to his confrontation and the defeat of an Egyptian army that was coming to the support of Jerusalem. Ties in perfectly with what we read in 2 Kings 19. He doesn't name the commander, Sennacherib doesn't, but the Bible identifies him in 2 Kings 19 and Isaiah 37 as Taharqa. And you may want to see him. Here he is. This is Taharqa. Well, it will be when he decides to come on screen. That's Taharqa. He's the little guy sitting under the ram. That is the Amun god. That was his ram and that was his protection. And there he is. That's Taharqa, the king of Egypt. Actually, he wasn't king at the time that he went out. He was crown prince and he was in charge of the army. He's just king here. But now the representatives of Sennacherib were haranguing Hezekiah's men from just below the walls of Jerusalem, and they mocked the idea that any reliance could be placed on Egypt. Look now, the Bible records, you are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend on him, Isaiah 36. Sennacherib was right. The Egyptian army was soundly defeated. Plan A, plan B, failed. Hezekiah now fell back on plan C. He must ensure that Jerusalem would have an adequate supply of water and deny the Assyrians access to water. Therefore, Hezekiah's engineers blocked off all the springs and streams that flowed through the land, 2 Chronicles 32. But they did something else. And it was even more radical. We are told that they blocked up the upper outlet of the Gihon spring and they channeled the water down to the west of the city of David, 2 Kings 20. Now, to achieve this, they carved an underground channel deep in the limestone rock on which the city was built. It ran for almost 1,748 feet from the Gihon spring near the floor of the Kidron Valley outside the eastern wall of the city and wound underground to the Siloam pool safely within the city walls. The gradient is just 0.6%, and at the deepest point the tunnel is almost 160 feet below the surface. Archaeologists are still debating how on earth the tunnelers, starting from both ends, with only their tiny little lamps to guide them, could have followed a course underground and meet halfway. Mind you, it wobbles a bit, it curves a lot. If they'd gone straight, they could have saved themselves an awful lot of work. But they did get there. What no one doubts is that it was achieved by the engineers of King Hezekiah as the army of Sennacherib closed in 701 BC. Have any of you walked through there, been to Israel and walked through there? That's not me there, that's my friend who was ahead of me and I took it. Sometimes you have to wade through because the water's up to your waist. But there you can probably see it's just over our ankles. And you can walk from one end to the other and you're walking through exactly the tunnel that Hezekiah's engineers built. And there was something more to be discovered, which I find quite intriguing. In 1880, a young boy skipping school found an inscription chiseled into the rock at the halfway point. It was the left behind by the men who finally broke through and met each other in the middle. The inscription left by Hezekiah's engineers in part reads like this. While the stonecutters were swinging their axe, each man towards his fellow, and while there were still 3 cubits to be cut through, there was heard the voice of a man calling to his fellow, for there was an overlap, a crevice I think they mean, in the rock on the right. And when the tunnel was driven through, the quarrymen hewed the rock, each man towards his fellow, axe against axe. And the water flowed from the spring towards the reservoir for 1,200 cubits, and the height of the rock above the heads of the quarrymen was 100 cubits. How on earth did they know at that time how low, how deep they were beneath the surface of the ground? Incredible. Meanwhile, confident that Jerusalem would soon be breached, the officers of Sennacherib could boast to the city defenders that no army had ever been able to stand in the way of Assyria, and that one by one the gods of the nations had fallen before the might of the great king. It's all there in 2 Kings 18. Within the city, Isaiah the prophet promised, quote, "This is what the Lord says concerning the king of Assyria. He will not enter the city or shoot an arrow here. He will not come before it with shield or build a siege ramp against it. By the way he came, he will return. He will not enter the city." Isaiah 37. And interestingly, archaeologists have found no evidence of any siege ramp against Jerusalem at this period. What they believe they have discovered are blockhouses on the roads leading in and out. So the Assyrians set up blockhouses so that nothing could go in or out of the city. But there's no evidence that they actually laid siege to the city. And you probably know why. Because Plan D was the real plan, the original plan of God. 2 Kings 19:35-36 records that the next morning 185,000 men in the Assyrian camp lay dead, slain by an unseen hand, and Sennacherib returned home with the remnant of his shattered army. Now, like all monarchs, in the ancient world, when Sennacherib went back with the remnant of his army, he must portray his campaign in Judea as a victory. And there must be no mention of the loss of his army. It's no good anybody saying, well, why doesn't he mention that he lost? No king would ever mention that he lost 185,000 of his men. Because you never lost an army, a battle. And on this clay prism from Hezekiah, called the Taylor prism, because it was discovered by a guy called Taylor, he actually records how he confronted and defeated an Egyptian army that was coming in support of Jerusalem. Sennacherib also records the destruction in Judea of 46 strong cities, fortresses and small cities which were around him. That's what he says. He records that he deported 200,150 people from the land and animals as well. And he records the tribute that Hezekiah sent to him. And back home in Nineveh, remember, it's the crushing defeat of Lachish that he puts on his victory room, not Jerusalem. And all he claims in his records of Jerusalem is that he shut up Hezekiah in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. Absolutely true. Trouble is, he couldn't open the cage and get in to get the bird out. It was a frank admission, though he didn't see it that way, of his failure to take the city. So unless the biblical record is true, why did Sennacherib head for home in such a hurry without attempting to break into the capital? There can only be one explanation, and you'll read it in the Bible. Just as a final in memoriam of this dear man Sennacherib, 2 Kings 19:37 records the murder of Sennacherib by his sons whilst he was worshipping his god Nisroch. This Basil Steli, ordered by Nabonidus of Babylon, different empire, records that assassination in 681 BC because Nabonidus believed the Assyrian god Marduk was angry with Sennacherib for destroying Babylon. However, it's interesting that only the Bible provides the names of the assassins. The Bible describes one as Adramelech, and that fits exactly what we know from Assyrian records as the eldest son of Sennacherib, and the Bible calls the other one Sharezer, and we presume that that must be one of the other siblings as well. The Babylonians have something to say about it because Babylon had long been a threat to Assyria, and in the year 689 BC Sennacherib had trundled his army to Babylon and its king. Merodach Baladan was his name, he's in the Bible, and he fled the battle early to save his life. And on this Chicago prism, Chicago because it's kept in you know where, Sennacherib boasts that he entered Babylon jubilantly and there was no destruction. He just helped himself to the treasures. "I opened his treasure house, gold, silver, vessels of gold, silver, precious stones, and of every name, goods and property without limit. Heavy tribute, his harem, courtiers, officials, singers, male and female, all his artisans, as many as there were, his palace servants, I brought out and I counted the spoil." In other words, substantial takings. For a while, Merodach Baladan continued to rule in the south of Babylonia, and he needed some friends. So he chose to be nice to Hezekiah of Judah. And this is the point at which Hezekiah boastfully showed his ambassadors all his armory and his treasury. And the prophet Isaiah warned Hezekiah that any alliance with Babylon, the future world power, would prove disastrous. 2 Kings 20. But just let me take you back for a moment into the city of Jerusalem. Because back in Jerusalem, a guy called Shebna, or to give him his full name, Shebaniah, was as arrogant as he was extravagant. Next to the king himself, he was the most important man in the royal household. But the prophet Isaiah was not pleased with him. Isaiah 22. What are you doing here? And who gave you permission to cut out a grave for yourself here, hewing your grave on the heights and chiseling your resting place in the rock? Now, nobody but royalty should be buried within the city of Jerusalem. But Shebaniah, chief of the palace household, thought he was above that. In 1870, an inscription was discovered in Jerusalem. And on a tomb lintel cut into the rock. In 1953, the faint Hebrew script was translated. It's not faint now because they've picked it out for us to be able to see. It was translated as, "This is Shebaniah who is over the house. No silver or gold in the tomb, only the bones of the owner and those of his maidservant." I'm not sure what she's doing in there with him. And then there followed the usual curse on anyone who violates the tomb. Now, archaeologists agree that the lintel dates to the time of Hezekiah, and therefore this is more than likely the tomb that Shebna intended to use for himself, the very one that's referred to in Isaiah 22. In fact, according to the Bible, Shebna never used this tomb because he was destined, according to Isaiah 22 verse 18, he was actually destined to die in exile. In the British Museum, where this is housed at the present time, they actually refer to the Shebaniah of Isaiah 22. And when the British Museum link it with the Bible, you can be pretty sure it is true, because they don't do it unless they really have to. And staying with Shebna, remember those seals and bulle we were talking about? Well, here's the bulle which reads, "Belonging to Shebaniah, servant of the king." So here's the seal impression of that bad boy in the palace. Oh, and those little blobs on it of clay perhaps held the string in place that secured the document. And you might as well see also the bulla from Shebna's boss. It reads, "Belonging to Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah." The image on it is that of a dung beetle, known as a scarab in the ancient world. And the dung beetle was a symbol of the sun moving across the sky and a symbol of new life. And the scarab was very popular in Egypt. And you may ask them, what is it doing on the seal of one of the best of Judea's kings? And I suspect that it reflects the time of his vain treaty with Egypt. And he put a dung beetle on it as an illustration. If you want to know the story of the dung beetle, you can bring that up in Q&A and I'll tell you. In 648 BC, Babylon had been burned by the Assyrians after a 3-year siege, and it was now payback time. In 612 BC, Nabopolassar of Babylon captured the Assyrian capital Nineveh and wreaked a terrible revenge from which the city never recovered. The biblical prophet Nahum, remember that little prophet, vividly warned the Assyrians that their great capital would be totally destroyed by fire and water. Quote, there the fire will devour you, the sword will cut you down. Now these fire-blackened reliefs recovered from the palace at Nineveh just show how accurate Nahum's prophecy was. You can see the burned scorch marks of a terrible fire on the left, and it didn't reach quite through over onto the right. And slowly, the whole of the city of Nineveh crumbled into the sand and was entirely lost to human memory. Nothing remained that Nineveh had ever existed except the record in the Bible. So completely was the city lost and buried that 2 centuries after its destruction, the Greek historian Xenophon sat on top of the ruins and had no idea what city he was sitting on. Scholars in the 19th century even questioned whether such a city ever existed, because the only record of it was in the Bible. And there it lay buried for nearly 2,000 500 years. And then in 1847, a British archaeologist, Austin Henry Layard, discovered the palace and those reliefs of the siege of Lachish that I've just been talking to you about, and those burnt walls that you've just seen. And it caused great excitement in Victorian England because it was the first archaeological confirmation of the Bible. Now, the Assyrians relocated to Haran, and from Haran they fell back to a place called Carchemish. And in 609 BC, Pharaoh Necho II of Egypt marched out to help Assyria. And at this point, Josiah, king of Judah, made a fatal decision. He thought he could intercept and face off the Egyptian army, but he couldn't. And he was killed in battle, as the Bible records, and his successor Jehoahaz lasted only 3 months before Necho hauled him away in chains to Egypt and placed Josiah's grandson, Jehoiakim, and I emphasize the M because his son was called Jehoiakim. Wasn't very clever if they wanted to call him in from play. It sounded as though Mum was talking to Dad. And Jehoiakim was placed on the throne. But Jehoiakim had to pay a very heavy price to stay there, according to 2 Kings 29. Meanwhile, the power block is changing. Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian crown prince, was on his way to settle with the combined force of the Egyptians and the Assyrians. And at the Battle of Carchemish, a very famous battle in 605, the Allies were defeated soundly and the Assyrian Empire was at an end. The Egyptian army was virtually annihilated, as the prophet Jeremiah had warned. Now the Babylonians actually left us clay tablets recording a lot of their history. This little tablet is about 4 inches, 5 inches high. They're known as the Babylonian Chronicles, and the one you're looking at records that very battle of Carchemish in 605 BC, and it's referred to in the Bible. It relates that Crown Prince Nebuchadnezzar took command of the army, marched to the Euphrates, crossed the river, and fought with the Egyptians at Carchemish. It concludes that the Egyptian army was defeated to non-existence, which sounds like annihilation, and those that escaped the battle, quote, the Babylonian troops overtook and defeated them so that not a single man escaped to his own country. This is the battle Jeremiah refers to in Jeremiah 46 and verse 2. Concerning Egypt, this is the message against the army of Pharaoh Necho of Egypt, of king of Egypt, which was defeated at Carchemish on the Euphrates River by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah. Now Nebuchadnezzar was now in control up from Syria to the Egyptian border. For 3 years, Jehoiakim, king of Judah, paid him the annual rent, and then one day he completely misjudged the state of play. Babylon and Egypt clashed in 601 BC, and the Babylonian Chronicle admits that in the hard fight, quote, they inflicted great havoc on each other. When Nebuchadnezzar returned home to rebuild his army, Jehoiakim withdrew his support, didn't want to pay rent anymore. 2 Kings 24 records, during Jehoiakim's reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, invaded the land and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. But then he changed his mind and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. Now it wasn't long before Nebuchadnezzar fetched up at Jerusalem and Jehoiakim was captured, probably died on his way to exile, 2 Chronicles 36, and his son Jehoiakim was just 3 months on the throne before he too was ordered to Babylon. 2 Chronicles 36 tells us this. On this side of the same Babylonian chronicle, Nebuchadnezzar records his visit to Jerusalem. He says that he encamped against the city of Judah, and on the second day of the month Adar, he seized the city and captured the king. He appointed there a king of his own choice, that was Zedekiah, received a heavy tribute, and sent them to Babylon. Notice the exact day and month is recorded. And so it's possible to date precisely that capture of Jerusalem, recorded in 2 Kings 24, as the 16th of March, 597 BC, precisely. I wonder if this was the time when the Ark of the Covenant was removed from the temple, never to be seen again. So, Jehoiakim and his family and officials were taken to Babylon and thrown into prison. And there, an interesting story begins. Nebuchadnezzar had a son called Emil-Marduk. He is called Evil Merodach in the Bible, though evil doesn't mean evil. It just happens to be the Hebrew word. Apparently, Emil-Marduk had fallen out with his father and was himself in prison. And we have on record his pathetic prayer in prison, pleading his innocence. He claims that all day and every day, all night and every night, I quote, "The wretched, weary person weeps. The wretched, unseeing person sheds tears. He sheds tears because of the tricks of mankind. He weeps in his prison because his situation is so grievous. He sheds tears over matters not to be spoken, the evil done to him." You know, you're in tears by the time you get to the end of it. He's really saying, "I'm not really a bad boy. I haven't done anything wrong." Now, apparently, an unexpected friend was on the way, because Nebuchadnezzar took Jehoiakim captive to Babylon, as we are told, and we have the ration book of Jehoiakim. This is the ration book from the Babylonian royal archives of Nebuchadnezzar, detailing the food allowance for Joachim, that's Jehoiakim, king of the land of Judah, and his sons. And if any of you ladies want to go shopping, you can actually go and collect the food ration for the family. I won't read it all to you. If you want to take it down afterwards and go to the store and try and pick it up, you're welcome to do so. Now, Jehoiakim, seems to have hit it off well with Amel-Marduk, because the first thing that Amel-Marduk did when he eventually became king in 562 BC was to release Jehoiakim, talk kindly to him, and give him the highest seat of honor among the royal exiles. And if you don't believe that, just read 2 Kings 25, 27 to 30, and you'll see it. Unfortunately, Amel-Marduk was assassinated within 2 years, and we've no idea what happened to Jehoiakim after that. Meanwhile, back in Jerusalem, for 9 years, Zedekiah, Nebuchadnezzar's puppet, behaved himself. The rent was paid regularly and on time. Then Zedekiah changed his mind and rebelled, and Nebuchadnezzar paid another visit to Jerusalem, but he wasn't sightseeing. On the way, he stopped by Lachish, and the city suffered yet another devastating siege and destruction. Remember Sennacherib in 701? Well, here we are. Much later, 587. As the army closed in on the city in 587 BC, an officer in a military outpost sent an urgent message to his commanding officer at Lachish. Scribbled on this broken piece of pottery, it's called a strakon. It's the equivalent of the back of an envelope or a post-it note. You see, the housewives in those days were as clumsy as they are now, and they were always breaking pots and pans, and they were all made out of pottery. So there was always plenty of writing paper around. This one is interesting because it actually includes the words, "May Yahweh cause my Lord to hear the news of peace this very day, this very day." It was an urgent but vain hope. But what is special about it is that you don't often find the divine name of the Lord written in this kind of format. That is the name that appears in many of your modern translations, L-O-R-D in capital letters. It's the divine name, Yahweh, in the old translations, Jehovah. And there it is. Remember, Hebrew reads from the opposite way to us, so you're going from right to left. That's the name Yahweh. When Nebuchadnezzar finally arrived at Jerusalem in 587 BC, it was all over for the city and its king. Remember the story, Zedekiah saw his sons killed before he himself was blinded taken into exile. 2 Kings 25. Jeremiah 39:3 names a number of the Babylonian officials who took charge in Jerusalem. One of them was called Nebo-Sarsekim. In the summer of 2007, an Austrian scholar found a small clay tablet in the British Museum which records how an officer of Nebuchadnezzar lavished a gift of gold on the temple in Babylon. It is none other than the Nebo-Sarsekim who 8 years later was helping to run Jerusalem, and to date no one has disputed that identification. The prophet in the city of Jerusalem when Hezekiah was there, giving you the answer to the question, was Isaiah. The prophet in the city of Jerusalem, right at the very end in 587 when Zedekiah was king, was Jeremiah. Do you remember what happened to poor Jeremiah? Well, as the Babylonian closed in on Jerusalem, Gedaliah and Jehukal, together with a few other thugs, plotted to rid the city of the troublesome prophet Jeremiah. We have their names: Shephatiah, son of Mattan, and Gedaliah, son of Pashur, and Jehukal, son of Shelemiah. In the summer of 2008, an Israeli archaeologist, Eilat Mazar, announced that she had found a small seal impression that belonged to, quote, Gedaliah, son of Pashur. at a place and a date in Jerusalem that almost certainly identifies it with the man who threw the prophet Jeremiah into a deep cistern. And Eilat also found a seal impression of the co-conspirator Jehuchel, son of Shelemiah. So there are the two bad guys that threw Jeremiah into prison. In 1975, a clay buller, that's the impression, remember, came onto the market reading, "Belonging to Berechiah, son of Neriah, the scribe." That is the Berechiah, son of Neriah, Jeremiah's secretary of Jeremiah 45 verse 1. So you're looking at the seal impression of Jeremiah's secretary. In 1966, another identical one came to light, and that's the one you're looking at. And this one even had a fingerprint on it. We might even have the fingerprint of Jeremiah's secretary. The king of Babylon was old Nabonidus. He had a son. Not everybody thought so. Half a dozen years after Marduk released Jehoiakim from prison, Nabonidus was in charge at Babylon. Here's a stone relief of him, worshipping three of his gods. Daniel 5, 7 and 8 claim that he had a son called Belshazzar, but there was no other known reference to a son by that name. So, in 1850, a German scholar by the name of Ferdinand Hitzig wrote a commentary on the book of Daniel, and he said that Belshazzar was a figment of the writer's imagination. I bet he wished he'd never written that, because just 4 years later, J.E. Taylor, the British consul in Basra, discovered four identical time capsules from some building works of Nabonidus, in which he offers a prayer for himself. They're about that long, or no, probably about 8 inches long. He offers a prayer for himself and for Belshazzar, my firstborn son, the offspring of my heart. So nobody today doubts the existence of Belshazzar. But there's actually a little bit more to the story than this. Nabonidus had been away with his army in Arabia for about 10 years, and he left his son in charge at Babylon as regent. And of course he threw big parties like the one that Rembrandt reminds us of, Belshazzar's feast. But this is why Daniel was appointed only the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Daniel 5:29. Nabonidus was number one, but he was out of town. His son Belshazzar, who was reigning in Babylon as de facto king, was number two, and therefore Daniel could only be number three. It all fits perfectly together. The Babylonian Empire lasted for little over half a century. Nabonidus had never been a popular king, and one night in 539 BC, someone traitorously opened the gates of Babylon and let the Persians in. The city was neither sacked nor looted, although Daniel 5:30 informs us that on that very night the king was killed. On the other hand, the records of the Persian king Cyrus tell us that the king was taken prisoner. One of them's got to be wrong. Well, no. Both records are actually right. Belshazzar was killed in Babylon on the night the Persians broken in, but remember, his dad is away fighting battles in Arabia, and he was captured and taken prisoner sometime later. Now this is the Cyrus cylinder. Although it lives in the British Museum in London, it is still a national icon of Iran. A copy resides in the United Nations headquarters in New York. It has been translated into all the official languages of the UN, and it is often referred to as the first Charter of Human Rights. Why all the fuss? Well, here, Cyrus recorded his capture of Babylon, but he also added something else of great interest. He told how he gave permission for many of the exiled nations to return to their homeland and take their gods back with them. This was a new idea. He was going to get everybody on his side and say what a wonderful king he is, because he's letting everybody go back home. Now, he doesn't mention the Jews on this cylinder, but in 2 Chronicles 36:23, we read, "This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judea. Any one of his people among you, may the Lord his God be with him and let him go." He allowed them to go back and rebuild their city and rebuild their temple. They didn't have any gods to take back, so he said, all right, you can go back and rebuild your temple as well. Oh, and by the way, the treasury will help pay the cost. What a very nice man he was. We call it back home quantitative easing. You have another phrase for it. You call it Obama money, right? Now, for years, it was assumed by critics that no pagan king would ever issue such a decree. Therefore, the Bible was wrong. Of course, no one doubts that at all now. Cyrus did. That's exactly what he offered. And here it is in clay. And since the Jews, I say, had no gods to carry around, he told them they could rebuild their temples. And so the story of the two great empires of Assyria and Babylonia come to a close, and the story of the vastly more wealthy and extensive empire of Persia opens, but that is another story that I haven't time to tell you. But I hope you can at least see that archaeology, correctly understood, always confirms the accuracy of the Bible. There are a few books I would recommend to you. I'm not sure that you have these. These are written by my colleague, Clive Anderson, both from day one, so make a note of them. Sennacherib, Encountering Assyria's Great and Terrifying Ruler. And then a lovely little commentary on the book of Nahum, because that, of course, is a prophecy that we've already been looking at. And then if you want to look at the Bible through the British Museum, just take that one for the moment. We take people through the British Museum, gallery by gallery, case by case, item by item, and that book does the same. And if you never go to London, never go to the British Museum, don't worry, because there's a lot of good stuff in there. Some of the things I've told you here today are in there, and you've got, therefore, the text that you need for it. So I really would commend that as a very simple, easy, there are 150 photographs in there, so you can see, you'll recognize some of the things you've already seen. If you want the kind of backup information so you've got it to remember, that's the book for you. In Nothing But the Truth, I do deal with the question of archaeology a little bit. Why 27 is another matter completely. That's how we know we've got the right 27 books in our New Testament.